Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Steve Ronalds and Sally Jones began Gippsland Jersey back in 2016. Their idea was to actually help give dairy farmers a fair go and try to minimise the massive mental health impacts on fellow farmers struggling to survive in the face of farm gate milk price decimation at the hands of large supermarket retailers offering milk at a buck a litre. This was truly unsustainable for farmers. Starting with a background in farming and milk production, this just seemed to make logical sense. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So, Steve, what inspired you to get involved into sustainably priced milk production?
It could go back generations, to be honest. It's been a fourth generation dairy farmer. We'd been buying the family farm after, after finishing school, all I wanted to do was be a dairy farmer. That's just, had no other ambition in life but to be a dairy farmer. And that was following in my great-grandfather's footsteps. He settled the farm that we're on back in the 1890s. So, you know, it goes back quite a while, the generations of farming. And I just worked through the ranks working on other farms after school until our farm got big enough. And then I was able to end up there all the time. My brother was on the farm too, an older brother, and my dad. And my older brother ended up getting out because of health issues. So it was just my dad and myself. And I just worked up through an apprenticeship and then ended up just working. And then we share farmed it. Then we leased the farm off mum and dad. And then eventually we started buying the farm off them. Just hand the farm over to the next generation. All of our succession planning, you know, through the farms and the way it's operated is, you know, there's a commercial price put on the farm, the value. And then we've got to pay that for it off the previous generation to give them, you know, a reasonable retirement. And obviously there's help with the bank of mum and dad as well as the bank of the bank. So, yeah, so that's where the process has been. But we'd been doing that for probably 5 or 6 years trying to make payments and we just weren't making any progress. It was a real battle in those, you know, mid-2000s, probably early, late 90s, early 2000s. The industry really took a dive and just the ups and downs of the industry just seemed to disappear. And look, there was the odd ups in there, but they weren't anywhere near as high as what they had been. And the lows were much deeper than what they probably had been historically. So I guess, yeah, we were just trying to make ends meet. I was working off the farm for a couple of the milk factories, learning a bit of the back end of the industry, which now is very beneficial. Hindsight's always a wonderful thing. And I'm convinced that the journey that we're on through life, that we go through in life is leads us to the next purpose or the next reason why we're doing it. There's always reasons why we're doing things. And so all those learnings in the industry were, I suppose, just scattering little seeds in my brain about, you know, what we should be doing. And it actually took a motorbike accident where I was laid up in bed for quite a few months. I was out of action for months. Where the mind just started ticking as to, you know, what are we doing with this? I've got three children and I honestly didn't want them to be in the dairy industry. I just thought we'd be the last generation in the farm because I just couldn't see much opportunity for them in there. I just figured what's the point, you know, it's, they'll just flog themselves all their lives to, you know, be probably in a similar position to we are. We're just like massively in debt without much chance for improvement the way the industry had been going. So it was through that accident, I guess my mind was just a bit more vacant than usual and more things were going around and around and it just got me thinking and there was a few sort of little circumstances happened, but that maybe we just need to value add to the milk on our farm and that would be the only way forward for us to go because it just guaranteed that we would get a fair price for the produce that we're producing. So I guess that's where the seeds started. A friend of mine, Sally Jones, who's now my business partner. Her family, it sort of had a bit of a similar situation. They had a dairy farm milking Jersey cows like we were up in Lakes Entrance. And just they just found things incredibly hard through the size of their farm, their location, where they were, to make ends meet as well. So they ended up value adding to their milk and turning theirs into ice cream. And they would have ice cream, some ice cream shops throughout Gippsland. And it was just that connection with their history. And Sally had some experience in PR and media and marketing that led us to join together to, you know, consider starting a milk brand.
Right. And was the supermarket majors driving the price down at a retail level? Was that a major trigger, or was that actually more of a marketing scam for them?
Look, it could be looked at from either
end. How much does supermarket retail price affect what farm gate price?
Probably back then it wasn't as much as what it was. The industry has shrunk a lot to where it is right now. So back then we were a net exporter. Most of our product that was made in Australia was exported overseas. It would be partially or fully produced and turned into a product and then sent over to feed the rest of the world. But with everything that's gone on over the last, you know, probably 10 years, the industry shrunk massively, and now we're actually, essentially, you'd actually call us a net importer of product. We probably don't actually produce enough dairy to feed our country anymore, which is a bit of a scary thought. So I think, in answer to your question, it had an effect, and I think it put a lot of pressure on the processors, who would then pass that back to the farmers. And I mean, a trick that the bigger processors have always used is, you know, one year they'll be talking about the Australian dollar was down because we're a net exporting, you know, country. And, you know, the dollar might have gone up, which means, you know, the value that we pay the farmers is going to be a little bit less. But then the next year the narrative might shift a little bit because, you know, that argument wouldn't always work. There'd always be something that would be shifting, and it would be very rare that the moons would align to give the farmers a reasonable price. So yeah. I think that domestic low price of the milk, because I think it had come back from about $1.40 a litre or $1.40 or 50 a litre down to $1 a litre, which is massive. It's a massive number, and it's got to get passed back to the farmers. As much as the supermarkets or the other companies might say, we'll pass that, you know, we'll absorb that. It's just not fact, and it couldn't happen. And it's funny how milk's always at the very back of the shop, and it's something, a staple everybody has to get. So, you know, they drop the price of that and they walk past all the shelves making money on that. And they always called it a loss leader. And I think it's pretty disgusting, to be honest.
Yeah, well, if it's a loss leader, then they're not going to make too high a loss on it, which means that I guess the producer does have to.
At the end of the day, someone has to.
Yeah.
Correct. And at the end of the day, there's a lot of noses in the trough that you know, need to get fed out of that. It starts with the producers, and even there, you know, the suppliers that from the farmers themselves. And then it goes back to the farmers, through the freight companies, through the milk processors, through the distributors, through the end users, and anyone else that might be in the middle there as well. And there's only so much to feed in that trough, and there wasn't enough. And look, I don't stand here and say that the farmers were the only one getting shafted. I'm sure that the supermarkets were, you know, well, they're not making good margin on the milk. It was impossible for them to be. And it would have been pushed throughout the whole, every one of those people in that chain along the way.
Yeah, for sure. So you're lying on your back after a motorcycle accident, and you're thinking, okay, there's got to be a better way, and we need to actually do some value add. And you and Sally got hitched up, you know, as business partners. She's got experience in PR and advertising. So then what happened? Then how'd you actually mobilize?
Well, the very first conversation that we had would have been probably in April. I remember exactly where it was and where I was standing that particular time, and Sally's father had just recently passed away. Unfortunately, he was a statistic to rural suicide. So taking a little step back further, earlier in April when I was laid up in bed, her dad, March maybe actually to be honest, but anyway, just around that period of time, her dad took his own life on the family farm. So he, after he'd finished milking and, you know, processing his milk into ice cream, and probably, look, I only ever met him once, but essentially, you know, from my understanding, he was Mr. Ice Cream. And when he finished all that up, I think essentially, you know, he probably lost a bit of his identity on who he was, and apparently just spiraled into a place of where there was no hope and no return for him, which is a really horrible story. And that was where the first conversation with Sally happened. Possibly maybe not the most appropriate conversation for me to have, as the first time I've seen her since this happened. She's telling me a bit about what had happened, which, you know, obviously I was sympathetic and, you know, understanding a little bit of what she was going through. But I also, in that same conversation, said to her, look, I think I really want to value add to the milk on my farm. Would it be something you'd be interested in helping me a bit with, your skills that you have in marketing and social media and this sort of stuff? And she was very heavily involved in the Warragul Farmers Market. She'd started that with one of her mates. And in the whole process of this, the dairy crisis was happening. At that stage, Murray Goulburn had just dropped their price really significantly and ended up going bust out the back door. Fonterra, the second biggest processor, if not second close to the biggest processor, also dropped the price. And what was going on in the industry was just horrific. There were farmers who were just, you know, going bankrupt. Farmers who were taking their lives and all this stuff. And it was such a horrific time. This is in 2016, and I think it will go down in history as, you know, the big dairy crisis. And during that time at the farmers market, Sally put a panel of farmers up on there to get the consumers to understand what was actually going on, because people were reaching out to the farmers market saying, how can we help the farmers? We know they're in pain and we know they're suffering. How can we help them practically? And so they got these four farmers to talk about what was going on in the industry. Very passionate. I was there. They were sitting outside the Arts Centre in Warragul. And the media was there. And there was a lot of people listening to these farmers telling the story as it was happening, very live and real. And it was actually after that, about 2 o'clock that afternoon, I get this text message from Sally saying, let's do it. Let's start this milk brand. And so I think that was in April or May. And by September, we had milk in a bottle. And it was pretty intense process to do that. Very full on, probably very emotionally charged. She was charged because of what was going on for her with her dad and her family and the grief that she was going through, and she was just channeling all her grief into trying to start Gippsland Jersey. And I guess I was pretty passionate and happy to be pretty outspoken about what was going on in the industry and what was happening to me personally. And so we just sat down really with a piece of butcher's paper and a few people, friends, mentors around us and family, and just said, what are we going to stand for? And it probably took no more than 20 minutes to come up with three pillars. And the three pillars were fair price for the farmers. The farmers have always got to be paid a fair price for the beautiful produce that they're making. Second one was around mental health and trying to, at that stage, it's probably shifted a little bit now, but at that stage was to really just try to smash that stigma of farmer suicide and mental health, or probably rural suicide and mental health. And particularly in my males at that stage, it was really something that was pretty shamed upon. It's not that long ago, but it's, the discussions are a lot more real and easy now than what they were back at that stage. And the third one was around kindness, because at that stage there wasn't a lot of kindness going on in the world, in a dairy world, and we just wanted to make a little bit of a difference. And I mean, at the end of the day, we could produce as much milk as possible. We could produce, you know, oodles of milk, but unless we could sell it and make a profit, we couldn't really do too much with it. We had to market it and sell it. So what we did, we just decided we would put a centiliter from every bottle of milk that we made, and we put that into a little account that we call our random acts of kindness account. And as that would just build up, and we're only talking $100, $200 or whatever it was at the time. Sometimes it was more. But we would just do random things for farmers to make a difference in their life at that stage. So it could be just sending a family to the movies, or it could be sending, you know, a female farmer to get a haircut or a nails done. We brought a bed for somebody because a farmer was sleeping on the floor. They couldn't even afford a bed. We sent, you know, people to the football, and just different things. They're just small little things that actually just made a difference, because when somebody does something kind to you, it makes an impact, and often that just reverberates through it. Either makes a shift in your own mental health and where the position you're in, or else you might even pass it on to somebody else. So that was a really enjoyable and fun and pretty special thing that we're able to do. Now, moving back, you know, 6 years later on, the industry is doing a lot better. And, you know, there's not as much of a need for that. Every now and then we'll still do something like that. But, yeah, we've probably shifted our focus a little bit more from that at this stage. But those three pillars are what we stand by, and that's what every decision that we make within our business always comes back to, those three pillars.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au. So you decided, okay, we're going to get milk into bottles. How did you actually get to market then? Because, you know, the obvious channels were, okay, what, farmers markets? I mean, the supermarkets wouldn't have been interested, or would they?
Initially, no. So we launched at the farmers market. So that was on September 2016 at Warragul, where the first decision was essentially made to actually do it. We processed about 5,000 litres of milk. And I remember seeing that milk go off in the truck from my farm at that particular stage. Got photos of the truck driving at the driveway, and just thinking, are we ever going to get any money back for that milk? Because even though I wasn't getting a lot for it, sending it somewhere else, at least we're getting a return. It was quite nerve wracking. Yeah, if we don't sell that milk, what are we going to do? But when we launched, you know, 2 or 3 days later, and we had the milk turn up in a little truck to sell at the farmer's market, there was just queues beyond what our wildest imagination was. We asked all our friends and family to come and help, just set it up. And look, we made quite a scene. We brought a cow, we brought a calf, you know. We had it all going on. We had some glass door fridges that were donated to us, and the distributor that we partnered up with was there with their vans, and we were pretty much trying to pull the milk out and put it in the glass fridges. But we didn't even have time to do that. What we ended up doing was just taking the milk pretty much as a box of milk, opening it, just handing it to people, and they'd just pay us for that milk and go on. And it was at that stage we thought, look, gee, people are actually backing this. They're actually behind what we're on about. And I think we'll be okay. And we had 4 or 5 of the smaller supermarkets, just your IGAs and Super Food Works, and just those independents, and some general stores and a few cafes that said, yep, we'll support you and use you. And that's how we got started. And some of them are still with us today, some of them aren't. It was quite when you think about it and consider what went on, it was pretty incredible, to be honest.
Very, very grassroots start, which is exactly the way so many successful businesses have started.
Yes. Yeah.
So tell me, how does your business model work now, 6 years down the track?
It shifted a lot. So when we first started, we wanted to have our milk contract processed. We studied a lot of the smaller dairies around Australia that, you know, did what we hoped to do. And what we found were that the majority of them were pretty small, just single one farm, so single source off one farm, and then they would just send their milk around their little area, which is great. And that's as far as they wanted to go, essentially. for us, that's not what we wanted to do. We really wanted to bring on a number of farmers to get paid a fair price. And sort of the goal was, and probably still is, to have a dozen farmers or 15 farmers who are just always getting paid a fair price for the milk. So to do that, we knew that we weren't going to set up a little factory on my farm. I haven't got town water. We didn't have enough power. We haven't got enough water on the farm anyway. So just some of those main, you know, the utilities that you just need weren't there. So we knew my farm was not the place to set up a little factory. So we just decided we would just send our milk out to be contract processed. So we found a person who could do that for us in Dandenong. And that gave us the ability to then go and just sell our milk. So Sally and I just wore out our boots, knocking on every shop, cafe, retail store, whatever we could find, pretty much from the New South Wales border all the way through to Melbourne. So the distributor that we had could service Gippsland and Melbourne. So we literally wouldn't see the milk. The milk would go off in a milk tanker. And if we wanted to hand a sample out to a particular shop or whatever, we'd literally just go to a supermarket, buy a milk, and then hand it to somebody else to take it, because we weren't processing it. Because like I was saying, most of the smaller companies that did what we do, we find that the farmer milks the cows like I would be, and then they would jump into their factory and process milk and turn it into cheese or milk or whatever they might do. And then they'd think, oh, hang on, we've got to get it delivered. So then they go do deliveries. And then they would have to come back, oh, it's milking time again. And that was just a cycle, and it's not a cycle that we wanted to get into. I'm not going to say we've got it right, because we work incredibly hard and are just in another cycle ourselves in our own business. But what it meant was that we could grow our business, and we just were totally, you know, not focused on anything to do with the product, but all to be do just was selling business, selling milk, and just to grow that business as fast as possible.
Yeah.
So we did that probably for 2.5-3 years. And then we got a phone call that, you don't really want to get from our contract processor, who says, hey guys, we can't process your milk after another 30 days. I'm just giving you 30 days notice that you need to find someone else to process your milk, which we didn't do a super big panic. We're actually looking at another milk factory in South Australia at that particular time, because we're starting to sort of, the seeds were sowing that once we got to a certain size, it would be time to process the milk ourselves. It would become economical and viable. So we were actually looking at this factory in South Australia when we got that phone call in the airport. And we actually just did a little live video sitting in the Adelaide airport on our social media. We just went on Facebook Live and did a little video and said, hey, we've just had this happen. We've just got this phone call. If anyone knows anyone who could, who could process the milk for us, just if you could let us know, that'd be great. And jump on the plane and, you know, an hour flight home and get there. And when we get back, the phones are just ding, 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 ding. And it went a little bit. People were just sharing it and trying to help and realize that, you know, we probably needed some assistance. And that's how we've rolled a fair bit with what we've done. But what we found was that there wasn't anyone suitable really to process our milk. It was actually quite tricky, because we were a bit too big for the really small people to process the milk, but we're still way too small for the big factories or big guys to want to do it. And they probably wouldn't do it anyway for us, to be honest, because we didn't get a yes from them anyway. But that's that. We found ourselves in this little pickle. So we ended up having to, the only place we could find the process our milk was 4 hours away in the Western District of Victoria. That was the only place. We had offers of people, oh, we can do it. We're in Queensland. We can do it. Or we can do it somewhere else, you know, but it just wasn't viable or able. So once again, we pulled out the butcher's paper, and we were sitting in the Warragul Library one time, because we never really had an office. And we were just thinking, what are the options of how we can do this? You know, we can't really find anyone to process our milk. What's the options for us to survive? Because the milk getting processed in the Western District wasn't viable at all. It just kept milk on the shelves to keep continuity of supply, which we thought was worth the risk of, you know, going broke for essentially. So it really come down to that at Sally's family farm up in Lakes Entrance, there was a factory sitting there that had a horse living in it, and a squatter hadn't been used for a number of years, was sitting there. And so I went for a drive, had a look at it afterwards and thought, well, that's actually got potential to turn into something if we had to, but it was sort of the last option. And so I spoke to Beck, my wife, and I said, what do you think about, what would you think about moving to Lakes Entrance if we decide to process that? And I really expected her not to be keen at all, and that would have been cool. We wouldn't have done it. But she actually said, that might be good for our family. So, yeah, maybe we should do it. So we jumped on and we did a little, you could call it a crowdfund, or we asked people to pre-purchase bottles of milk. So we didn't ask for money just to be handed to us. But they were $10 for each bottle of milk. So they're an expensive bottle of milk, absolutely. But the idea was that once we had that factory up and racing and operating, that we would then hand the bottle of milk back to that person and say, thank you very much, you know, for your support. And I think we did five social media posts on that, and we raised $110,000 in, you know, 20 days or something. That was quite wow. Incredible how that all come about. And that was able to just cover the things that we weren't able to finance. We had our bank manager, the CBA, really backed us with some old equipment. Our separator and our homogenizer are pretty old, that probably not normally financeable. But yeah, they backed us. And the important things, or the extra important things like our pasteurizer and our chili and things that really affect milk quality, we went and purchased brand new. And just finance all that. We financed ourselves as high as we possibly could go, and we used that $110,000 to, you know, rewire the factory and pour concrete and paint floors and pay for plumbers and the things that you just can't finance that you just need cash for, because we weren't, you know, like I said, we're bleeding money with our milk being processed in the Western District. So it was a pretty full on period of time, but we managed to scrape through. And then, yeah, here we are, we're processing our milk. Funnily enough, the fires in East Gippsland were very, very close to us just as we're about to open. We actually had our dairy food safe license audit booked in on January the 9th or 8th the 9th or something like that. And they couldn't come up because the roads were cut and we were actually blocked in by police that they couldn't, they wouldn't let anyone in or out to the property, because of risk of burning down. And we could see, you know, we're in significant risk, which we just finished this brand new factory, well, a brand new old factory. And then the risk of it possibly being burnt down was not an option to us. So anyway, here we are now.
And so now you're producing how many 1,000 litres a week or a day?
It's pegged back a little bit just at the moment, but yeah, sort of around 50,000 litres a week, we could call it.
Yep.
And milk.
And so how does that business model work now? Because you're actually not spending most of your time at farmers markets, is that right?
Yeah, correct. So like I said earlier, we really wanted other farms to come on board and just to try and support as many as possible. And we've now got four farmers who, you know, supply us, which is great. So it's my farm. I've got a great share farmer who looks after my farm to keep me focused on the business. And then we've got three other dairy farmers who now supply us most of their milk. We have got arrangements with the excess milk to get sent off to somebody else, which helps take some of the ebbs and flows and the you know, different times of year when we produce a little bit more milk than what we need.
Yeah.
But yeah, look, the model hasn't shifted massively. It's just that it's now a lot broader. Where and who we supply to. We now do a bit of our own deliveries, or we control the deliveries a lot more ourselves. We don't have distributors do much of our work. We supply to our market. Probably 97% of our customers we just supply direct to and have the relationship with them. So we take their orders and make sure they get the deliveries. We have delivery partners who deliver the product for us. Some of them are very, very close at the factory. They work within our business. They're still a contractor, but yeah, they're kind of a salesperson as well as delivery people. And then we've got a third party logistics company in Melbourne who does the rest of our deliveries, which is really good. We also supply Coles and Woolworths, both direct. through the DC, which works well, and direct to store for some of the smaller product lines that, you know, don't go through DC. So yeah, we've been able to have that relationship with them, and along the way keep the relationships with the smaller supermarkets and general stores and Ritchie stores and whatnot. So yeah.
And what's your product range?
So we do milk. We do three types of milk. So we do light, full cream, and unhomogenized with the cream on top. And then once we started our factory here at Lakes Entrance, we started doing butter as well, sour cream, and cream and buttermilk. In the butter, we do that in salted and unsalted butter. And then we do that in various SKUs as well. So we do sheets for the pastries, for the chefs, and in bulk. And then we do retail packaging size right down to 20 gram portions that can just be put ready to serve on people's plates. So, yeah.
And so that's quite a range. And how is profitability in across the business then? Is it do you see it as being a long-term viable business now?
Yeah, look, it has been good. We talked earlier about the supermarkets and how they played with and affected the industry and the business. And I sort of said, look, they had a fair impact on it. To be honest, now they're actually having a significant impact as well, because now the supermarkets actually have their own supply direct with the farmers. And funnily enough, the cheapest milk in the supermarket, which obviously is owned by the supermarkets themselves, they've essentially got to pay the highest price to the farmers for that milk. In any normal industry, that just blows anyone's minds. But I don't think many people really understand that that's what goes on in it. Because at the end of the day, what they're doing, they're inflating the price of the milk paid to the farmers. So at the moment, the farmers are actually probably benefiting from that, which is great. The farmers are getting paid a really good price at the moment. Well, the best they've ever been paid. And I don't think you'll hear of any dairy farmers complaining of what they're getting paid this current season. It's relatively incredible, to be honest. But that then has put pressure back onto the rest of the processing companies and ourselves. I'm going to call ourselves one as well, because they've got to match these really high prices to pay the farmers. And I think the whole industry is under a fair bit of pressure because of that at the moment. So in answer to the question, look, we have been, I mean, milk is not a profitable business, and we know that from the start. But look, you know, we've been trading along okay, and our volumes have been enough that it works. This current season is really tight, to be honest, and it's quite difficult right at the moment. But we, you know, we will be able to trade through it, and we just keep going. But it's funny how just two big businesses can skew whole industries. And look, essentially they need to be called out for it, because it didn't make sense when they're paying, you know, selling at so cheap a price. If they were where it's, you know, losing the margin on the whole lot of that and still paying the farmers a fair price at the start, there wouldn't be an issue. But what happened is that so many farmers have left the industry. You know, the industry's probably shrunk nearly 30-40% in the last 10 years. And the problem is, like I said earlier, we are actually a net importer of dairy produce. So the price for milk has gone up, and that means that there's not enough milk around now. So we're really sort of, you know, if they had a bit wider view, they would have been able to understand that if we just pay the farmers a bit better earlier on, we'll keep them in the industry and we won't have the current issues that we have now. Yeah. So one of the supermarkets right now is trying to lock their farms in for 3 years at a really high price that probably doesn't reflect the narrative of what's happening with the milk around the world at the moment. America's milk prices, you know, dropping significantly every month at the moment. Europe is dropping every month significantly. And the major supermarket buyer has just said, oh, we're going to lock this ridiculously high price in for the next 3 years. Doesn't make sense.
So, yeah. So then when I think about Gippsland, Jersey, it's a micro producer, I guess would be the best way to describe it when you compare it to Bonterra and others. What's unique about Gippsland, Jersey that helps it deserve the supermarket space that it has and the premium pricing that it charges? and premium but fair.
Yeah. So I think it's finding our lane and sticking to it. So one of the unique things about Gippsland Jersey Milk is Jersey is actually a breed of cow. So they're little brown cows with the cute eyelashes and all this stuff, you know, a lot smaller frame. So they produce a higher fat milk. It's got more fat, it's got more protein, got more calcium, it's got more carrots, it's got more of everything in it, essentially, less water in the milk. So that means that for every, you know, bottle of milk that you buy, there is a lot more dense nutrient value in that. That's hard to explain to people, but that's the reality of why it tastes better. The other part of it is that anyone who buys Gippsland Jersey milk knows that, yes, it's a premium product, it's Jersey, but they also know that the farmers will always be paid a fair price for the milk, which I don't think any other company can hand on heart say that they can do that, because that's just our model. So we start with the farmers and pay the farmers first the right price and then just add all the margins on to dictate the price that the consumer has to pay, because at the end of the day, we can't go broke over it and we're not going to send our farmers broke. Whereas I think every other single dairy company in, you know, in Australia in the milk space starts with the consumer of what they think they need and work backwards from that. And I think that's a really big difference in the model. And people believe in authentic, you know, and grassroots. So we are the only, you know, Jersey producing milk in Gippsland or in Melbourne. So, you know, if you want quality milk, people need to come to us. Pretty much where the most, there is a little micro dairy in Gippsland as well. But, you know, in Gippsland, we are the only other producer of milk. There's none of the big companies have got white milk processing in Gippsland. We're the only one. That's quite unique. Gippsland and Eastern Melbourne, or the whole of Melbourne, is a huge catchment of people, and people want to support local. As long as we're price competitive, that's what people want to do. So it's funny. Look, yes, we've had to increase our price as we go along, and consumers seem to be supportive of that as we've done that. But yeah, we're a very unique business, very grassroots. Sally and I are so embedded in this business and work incredibly hard just to make this thing work and keep functioning day in, day out. But now we've got a good team of people around us. We've got, you know, a whole factory that's operating every day. I think there's 8 people in there working today, just processing cream. I think they're processing cream, the 3 white milks, and doing washing up, and more milk is arriving to go tomorrow. So that's just how our business rolls. It's operating 6 or 7 days a week, and it's it's very exciting.
And you mentioned price increases. How have you been able to make your way when faced with the brute force that the major supermarkets can apply? I mean, over the last 12 months, there must have been a requirement, I would have thought, with processing costs, staffing costs, lack of staff in the region and so on. It must have been a need for you to actually talk to some of your major purchasers about price increases. How have you gone with that?
Good. So we probably did a rookie mistake. So we were paying the farms right from the start the same price for the first almost five full years, because our price was better than everybody else was paying. It just worked. Our farmers were happy, and it was only at the end of last season that we probably didn't quite stay competitive with the market. It was at that stage that, you know, the rest of the market finally caught up to us. The problem with that was that after 5 years, we hadn't done a price increase either, because we didn't really need to. The rookie mistake is that we probably should have been increasing the prices and reviewing them every 6 months or 12 months, because when we did do the price rise, we had to do a reasonably significant one, which, look, we did lose a couple of people, but even then, most people were very understanding. That was in May last year that we did that. So yeah, look, but it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough, and we're just currently doing another one at the moment, because just all the costs have gone up. And like I said, we've had to pay more to the farms than what we had budgeted for and planned for, because the other companies, you know, paying more, and we've got to be competitive. So it's been tricky. Each of our 4 farmers came up to me and just said, look, at the end of the day, if you guys have to pay us a bit less, You paid us a premium for the last 4 years or 5 years. So we're very happy. We don't need to be price matched or anything like that, because the last thing we want to do is for Gippsland Jersey to go broke. And, you know, and then we've just got to go back to supplying the bigger companies. So the farmers are quite incredible in their attitude towards us and their allegiance to us, which is amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess you've earned that throughout the years. So when you think about the things that you've learned over the last 6 years, what have been the major roadblocks that you've hit along the way, and how did you overcome them?
Oh, gee, there's so many roadblocks along the way, isn't there? I mean, yeah, look, some of them are self-inflicted. So for us, we decided when we started the business that we were all about local. You can't preach something and live a different life to what you preach. So, and that's who we are. That's how we roll. That's who, you know, embedded in who Sally and I are. So we made sure that we used a local family-owned, you know, distributor or delivery company. That was part of what we just said. That's what we have to do. The contract processor who processes our milk, we said they have to be Australian owned and ideally families if they can. We found that the people who manufacture our boxes that we put the milk in, they're made just up the road from my farm in Nearham South. And yes, we know we can get them cheaper elsewhere, but if we don't support our own backyard, those businesses will go under, and it's just a bad spiral, and we don't want to be a part of that. So in answer to your question, some of those become roadblocks, and we've got to keep communicating to our customers, well, this is who you're supporting when you do that. The milk tanker that brings the milk up to a factory, yes, we could use one of the big companies that, you know, has shareholders all around the world or whatever, but we use a little fella who's based in Druin in West Gippsland, who's got two or three milk tankers, and he's the fella who we bump into at the local shop at the same time, you know. So that's how our business rolls, and that in itself is a roadblocker. The contract processing is expensive. It was really good. It got us off our feet. But we knew we had to process our milk at the same time, and finding that right time to do that is really, really difficult. Sometimes you just got to make those jumps and just, you know, step in and do it. That one we're forced into, which was probably actually a blessing in a lot of ways, not probably what we had expected or wanted to do so fast, but it probably actually worked really well for us, and it's really set us up, you know, to fit in our place in the market. Sometimes loyalties can be a problem as well. That we had a distributor who we were using that probably was holding us back a bit, but because they're just a small and they're family owned, you have those bit of relationship with them. That ended up falling over when they decided to bring another Jersey milk into their line that they would deliver, which we didn't think was fair or reasonable because we were very restricted in what we could do. But we probably should have made some decisions and harder decisions earlier to pull the pin and go direct, because that's what works for our model at the moment, is going direct to the customer. I mean, they're just a few. Look, there's so many things, you know, we can elaborate on.
And so you've gotten to where you're at now, and you've got a strong and viable business. Are you looking to expand dramatically? Or continue on with where you're at and how you're running it?
No, look, we still want to grow. Look, we're very committed to growing our business further. Like I've said a couple of times, we really want to have, you know, 10 or a dozen suppliers supplying our brand. That's where we would like to get to. I mean, it could be a lot more, but we don't want to become a massive big player in the industry. It's not what really floats our boat. But we would like to keep growing in that space. I think we've had incredible growth. Look, every year it was pretty much 70% growth year on year for the first 4 years.
Wow.
And it was a crazy ride. It was really hanging on and trying to steer the ship the best we possibly could, because it's hard to run a business as that and cash flow and, you know, just keep rolling. Thankfully, with milk, it's very, very fast moving. The cash is in and out very quick. So it's probably not a bad business to grow at that speed. We don't have to hold much stock. It's very, very quick moving, which is good. So look, we're setting up more of a team around us to allow us to do that. We've now got more of a sales and marketing team, and we recently put a full-time salesperson on who's just out and about in Melbourne all day, every day, pursuing customers. We've got more of a much more of a planned, strategic, a plan around our whole sales and marketing plan, and the whole business in general. But very focused with the whole team around that, and we're trying to really develop the team at the factory so that, you know, they're not as reliant on myself, because I've been in there full time all the time, with other people bringing that in, and just, I guess we're just maturing and pulling up our big kid pants as we grow up, I suppose you could say.
Mm. And are you looking to relocate and expand?
Look, anything's on the agenda for us. Look, it's our location's not perfect. What we do, we have to freight our milk up a fair way from, you know, West Gippsland into East Gippsland. It does give us access to markets in, you know, New South Wales, which we take on. All of our milk, like I said, is coming up. So it would make sense for us to be in a different location. But look, it's working at the moment. Our eyes are very wide open to how it might work. I mean, we might keep part portion of the business in East Gippsland and move some of it at some stage. We're just not 100% sure on how that will look at this stage. Very wide vision. And especially around partnerships and collaboration and joint ventures with people. We talk to the people in the dairy space regularly in our patch. We try to bring them all together. We don't look at people as competitors so much, but rather as, you know, people that we can learn from and work with. And yes, we have our lanes, but we're all quite slightly different. And they will cross every now and then, and we'll probably cheese each other's off. Excuse the dairy pun there. Occasionally, but, you know, that's, you know, if we can just grow the whole industry together, it's a good thing. The dairy industry in Gippsland is just huge, and it's just not celebrated, not at all. That's the third biggest dairy region in Australia, and no one really knows anything about it. We're trying to put on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, Steve, if you could go back in time now and advise your younger self when you were starting this business, what advice would you give yourself knowing what you know now?
I've got to bite my lip and say, don't do it. Nah, look, you've got to have nerves of steel. Business is hard, and it's been harder. I mean, going through the whole COVID thing, look, that in a lot of ways, in the midst of it, was actually beneficial to us. It was horrible at the start. We probably benefited in the middle and probably out the other side of it as the world's sort of, you know, battling a little bit more and inflation's getting out of hand and, you know, prices are going through the roof. We're affected again. So that stupid word pivot that keeps getting put around, but it's so true that you've just got to have eyes wide open and not stick to the same thing all the time. But I guess sticking to what our core is, not steering too wide from that, you know, not trying to look at all the shiny things on the side that could be exciting and fun. It's sort of sticking to our core, but having a wide enough vision that we're not so narrow-minded that we can't do it. Look, we won't die wondering anymore. But look, it's a interesting space. It's actually quite enjoyable and fun most of the time, to be honest. And just even dealing with the majors and the supermarkets and I think people enjoy working with people who are generally grassroots and who are genuine. And look, I think we are pretty much like that. We say call a spade a spade, and not happy to shy away from that. We're probably not quite as edgy as what we were when you first started, because as you get a bit more bigger and a bit more of a, you know, following on our social pages and stuff, that, you know, you can get wallop every now and then, but, you know, equally you can go the other way as well and rise, you know, bring you up. So I'd definitely say, look, if you've got a dream and do it, and have a desire to do it, you just got to have a crack and really try. But it's hard work, and I think the businesses that I've seen or people I have watched and go, it's just, If you think you're going to get a huge, big, you know, paycheck and it's all going to be all this stuff and nice and rosy from the start, we haven't experienced that, that's for sure. We just did this with no pay. I don't think we took any pay for the first 2.5 or 3 years. It was just trying to skimp and save off what, I could make off the farm and what Sally could make through, her husband, through his work. And just the hours he put in are just, unrelenting, to be honest. So, Nerves of
And
steel
so,
and just keep going.
yeah, nerves are still, I like that, and keep going. So where do you see Gippsland Jersey in 5 years' time?
I would think that we would, in 5 years' time, we'd be double the size we are now. We've got capacity to do that where we are, or it could be elsewhere. I don't know. I haven't quite got a vision of that. Look, if I had a crystal ball, I'd think we might be have our base in a different location, still within totally 100% within Gippsland. Look, and it still wouldn't really change that much. Just be a bigger version of who we are. So we'll just have bigger. A bigger operation with, a team around us and a board who can, advise and hopefully we would be less hands-on, but still have that passion and that inner drive that, be so embedded in the business because that's what we want to do. 5 years is not very long. That'll fly very quickly. I don't think it'll be a heck of a lot business different. It'll just be bigger with a really solid team and we're slowly building and developing that now and creating the framework and the pillars to sort of, pull all that together and so we can, do it very safely and securely and strongly.
And with the strength of Australian food security, do you see that there's an opportunity for you to be an exporter, or is that off the table at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's definitely a possibility. We are restricted in this site, but it doesn't mean we can send our milk or products to someone else to make as well. So we don't have to have that control of everything. So it is something that we would like, and probably, yeah, within 5 years, I would think that would be part of our suite of products that our business does, or, part of who we market and sell to would be some different products around the world. Probably more so our butter and those longer shelf life products that, I mean, we get called for it all the time. There wouldn't be a week that would go by that we wouldn't get a phone call from somewhere around the world wanting our product. It's just trying to get it there in a way that, is economical and big enough volume that it's worth the extra cost that would, the business would have to wear to get it over there.
Absolutely. So, Steve, if a CEO is looking to improve their organization, from all of your years of experience and business learning, what critical few actions should they start doing tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Be considering the team around them or at least the system so a person can come in around behind them and pick it all up. Because at the end of the day, we can't do everything ourselves. So I think, yeah, if you're not ready for a team or, if we as a business can't afford that team, still setting yourself up with a framework that someone can just come in and build on those basic, foundations. To ensure you can grow, and make sure that you're ticking all those boxes of, you can make as much product as you want, but unless you can sell it and market it and people want what you're going to make, there's no point making it, especially in our space where it's so fast moving, The FMCG is just a different, it's a different word that I never really understood. But I think milk has got to be one of the fastest ones, bread's probably another one, probably worse, but there's not many that are so quick moving. So you've got to be very, very quick and aware of what's going on with that. Critical reactions for a CEO, trusting people. You can't do it all yourself. And putting people in key places that where your strengths are. So, for us, like I said, we went out contract packing and having our milk done elsewhere, and we were just selling and building the brand. One of the things that we really wanted to do was make sure that the finances were sorted and looked after. So we just had a bookkeeper who was just making sure they're on top of that right from the very start. Obviously, we were very close. I've never let that go, and I probably will never let that go. I do all the budgets and make sure, we're all still buzzing along okay, but to ensure that we're ticking all the boxes in the background and making sure our BAS is done on time and accurately and that sort of stuff. Doing that, and that doesn't really float my boat either, for me personally, it's finding the things that you're good at and you love, really focusing on them, and the things you're not so good at, bringing people to help with that to ensure they don't get missed. Yeah. Same with for us now, building a factory, we had to bring in contractors to help us navigate all their food safety plans and making sure, you know, our HACCP is correct and all that stuff. It's not stuff that can be taken lightly. Or, you know, our EPA and all the regulatory stuff, it's super important and critical. So once again, bring the people in around to help you where you're lacking those skills so you can learn them. For me, I don't know whether it's right or wrong, but one of the things that I really want to do, and not because I feel like I have to, but I want to make sure that every single process in our factory or our business is something that I personally can do if I need to. Not from a control point of view, but I want to be able to know as a small business, because we are still small in the scheme of it, that if you lose a key person in your team, that you can keep yourself and keep yourself getting through, even right through to, you know, how to make butter or how to pack milk or how to put the test on for, you know, in our lab or whatever. There's nothing in our business that... I haven't been able to do up at this stage, but I'm probably losing a bit of touch with some of the closest of our customers and some of the logistic channels, because at the end of the day, you need to do that. And we've got a really awesome team. That would be where I feel like I'm lacking of understanding anymore, but I can't keep hold of it. But it's been really important so I know who it is, and then I can understand our staff as well and understand the pain that they're going through. I was writing some... up at 5 a.m. with our factory operations lady who does all the organise all the packing, because I said, you know, at the moment you're our weakest link, because if you're not here, nobody knows what you're doing at this early hour of the morning. So I said, I'm going to come around, I'm going to shadow you, and we're going to jot it all down. And she said, well, I've actually done it all. You can just check it off. So, you know, we'll either go through it and just navigate that, because, you know, you've just got to look for those weaker points and make sure they get fulfilled.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Yeah, it's such a hard thing to be a small business and to be very hands-on and operational, but also to be able to let go of the things you need to let go at the right times. And look, I certainly am not, you know, good at that sort of stuff at all. I probably hang on to things too much. I think one of the things as a leader that in our business that I do get criticized for every now and then, which I find hard, is to be very direct with people. I don't like to micromanage people. Give them the boundaries and help them understand, oh, this is what we need to do. You need to do this particular job in a certain amount of time. I don't care how you get the job done. So they might ask me a question. I said, well, how do you want to do it? Or here's a few ideas. But what I'm sort of understanding is a lot of people like that real direction of just do it this way, and I'll do it exactly how you want and get out of there, rather than having that freedom to work out how their day might roll. And I find that hard, because personally I don't like being micromanaged either. And just understanding how different people react, and, you know, having to understand, you know, I've had plenty of farm workers over the years, and I think usually I understand how they operate. And then, you know, I've worked in a bit of the corporate sort of space and other sort of, you know, bigger business, so I sort of understand that a little bit. And then I've had to learn how factory workers and how different kind of process operators want to be taught and understood. So that's been a good learning for me, and something that I constantly have to work on. And I do get comments about, you know, just be a bit more direct about some things. So
fair enough. Steve, this has been really good. Thank you so much for sharing your learnings and your journey. And I wish you all the best with this.
Oh, thanks for having me, John. And thank you for your course that I did with you. I really, really enjoyed that and learned a heck of a lot through your CEO masterclass. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe where you listen to podcasts, follow us on LinkedIn for more insights, and share the show with other business leaders. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualised business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.